Pomodius, A Brief History of Tomorrow. This is page 220. The Miracle Pie. Evolutionary pressures have accustomed humans to see the world as a static pie. If somebody gets a bigger slice of the pie, somebody else inevitably gets a smaller slice. A particular family or city may prosper, but humankind as a whole is not going to produce more than it produces today. Accordingly, traditional religions, such as Christianity and Islam, sought ways to solve humanity's problems with the help of current resources, either by redistributing the existing pie or by promising us a pie in the sky. Modernity, in contrast, is based on the firm belief that economic growth is not only possible, but is absolutely essential. Prayers, good deeds, and meditations can be comforting and inspiring. But problems such as famine, plague, and war can only be solved through growth. This fundamental dogma can be summarized in one simple idea. If you have a problem, you probably need more stuff, and in order to have more stuff, you must produce more of it. Modern politicians and economists insist that growth is vital for three principal reasons. Firstly, when we produce more, we can consume more, raise our standard of living, and allegedly enjoy a happier life. Secondly, as long as humankind multiplies, economic growth is needed merely to stay where we are. For example, in India, the annual population growth rate is 1.2%. That means that unless the Indian economy grows each year by at least 1.2%, unemployment will rise, salaries will fall, and the average standard of living will decline. Thirdly, even if Indians stop multiplying, and even if the Indian middle class can be satisfied with its present standard of living, what should India do about its hundreds of millions of poverty-stricken citizens? If the economy does not grow, and the pie therefore remains the same size, you can give more to the poor only by taking something from the rich. That will force you to make some very hard choices and will probably cause a lot of resentment and even violence. If you wish to avoid hard choices, resentment, and violence, you need a bigger pie. Modernity has turned more stuff into a panacea applicable to almost all public and private problems, from Islamic fundamentalism through third world authoritarianism down to a failed marriage. If only countries such as Pakistan and Egypt could keep a healthy growth rate, their citizens would come to enjoy the benefits of private cars and bulging refrigerators, and they would take the path of earthly prosperity instead of following the Islamic Pied Piper. Similarly, economic growth in countries such as Congo and Myanmar would produce a prosperous middle class, which is the bedrock of liberal democracy. And in the case of the disgruntled couple, their marriage will be saved if they just buy a bigger house so they don't have to share a cramped office, purchase a dishwasher so that they stop arguing whose turn it is to do the dishes, and go to expensive therapy sessions twice a week. Economic growth has thus become the crucial juncture where almost all modern religions, ideologies, and movements meet. The Soviet Union, with its megalomaniac five-year plans, was as obsessed with growth as the most cutthroat American robber baron. Just as Christians and Muslims both believed in heaven and disagreed only about how to get there, so during the Cold War, both capitalists and communists believed in creating heaven on earth through economic growth and wrangled only about the exact method. Today, Hindu revivalists, pious Muslims, Japanese nationalists, and Chinese communists may declare their adherence to very different values and goals, but they have all come to believe that economic growth is the key for realizing their disparate goals. Thus, in 2014, the devout Hindu Narendra Modi was elected Prime Minister of India, largely thanks to his success in boosting economic growth in his home state of Gujarat, and thanks to the widely held view that only he could reinvigorate the sluggish national economy. Analogous views have kept the Islamist Recep Tayyip Erdogan in power in Turkey since 2003. The name of his party, the Justice and Development Party, highlights its commitment to economic development, and the Erdogan government has indeed managed to maintain impressive growth rates for more than a decade. Japan's Prime Minister, the nationalist Shinzo Abe, came to office in 2012 pledging to jolt the Japanese economy out of two decades of stagnation. His aggressive and somewhat unusual measures to achieve this have been nicknamed Abenomics. Meanwhile, in neighboring China, the Communist Party still pays lip service to traditional Marxist-Leninist ideals, but in practice it is guided by Deng Xiaoping's famous maxims that development is the only hard truth, and that it does not matter if a cat is black or white, so long as it catches mice. Which means, in plain language, do anything it takes to promote economic growth, even if Marx and Lenin would not have been happy with it. In Singapore, as befits that no-nonsense city-state, they followed this line of thinking even further, and pegged ministerial salaries to the national GDP. When the Singaporean economy grows, ministers get a raise, as if that is what their job is all about. This obsession with growth may sound self-evident, but only because we live in the modern world. It wasn't like this in the past. Indian Maharajas, Ottoman Sultans, Kamakura Shoguns, and Han Emperors seldom staked their political fortunes on ensuring economic growth. That Modi, Erdogan, Abe, and Chinese President Xi Jinping all bet their careers on economic growth testifies to the almost religious status growth has managed to acquire throughout the world. Indeed, it may not be wrong to call the belief in economic growth a religion, because it now purports to solve many, if not most, of our ethical dilemmas. Since economic growth is allegedly the source of all good things, it encourages people to bury their ethical disagreements and adopt whichever course of action maximizes long-term growth. Thus, Modi's India is home to thousands of sects, parties, movements, and gurus, yet though their ultimate aims may differ, they all have to pass through the same bottleneck of economic growth, so why not pull together in the meantime? The credo of more stuff accordingly urges individuals, firms, and governments to discount anything that might hamper economic growth, such as preserving social equality, ensuring ecological harmony, or honoring your parents. In the Soviet Union, when people thought that state-controlled communism was the fastest way to grow, anything that stood in the way of collectivization was bulldozed, including millions of kulaks, the freedom of expression, and the Aral Sea. Nowadays, it is generally accepted that some version of free market capitalism is a much more efficient way of ensuring long-term growth. Hence, rich farmers and freedom of expression are protected. But ecological habitats, social structures, and traditional values that stand in the way of free market capitalism are destroyed and dismantled. Take, for example, a software engineer making $250 per hour working for some high-tech startup. One day, her elderly father has a stroke. He now needs help with shopping, cooking, and even showering. She could move her father to her own house, leave home later in the morning, come back earlier in the evening, and take care of her father personally. Both her income and the startup's productivity would suffer, but her father would enjoy the care of a respectful and loving daughter. Alternatively, the engineer could hire a Mexican carer who, for $25 per hour, would live with the father and provide for all his needs. That would mean business as usual for the engineer and her startup, and even the carer and the Mexican economy would benefit. What should the engineer do? Free market capitalism has a firm answer. If economic growth demands that we loosen family bonds, encourage people to live away from their parents, and import carers from the other side of the world, so be it. This answer, however, involves an ethical judgment rather than a factual statement. No doubt, when some people specialize in software engineering while others spend their time taking care of the elderly, we can produce more software and give old people more professional care. Yet, is economic growth more important than family bonds? By daring to make such ethical judgments, free market capitalism has crossed the border from the land of science to that of religion. Most capitalists would probably dislike the title of religion, but as religions go, capitalism can at least hold its head high. Unlike other religions that promise us a pie in the sky, capitalism promises miracles here on earth, and sometimes even provides them. much of the credit for overcoming famine and plague belongs to the ardent capitalist faith in growth. Capitalism even deserves some kudos for reducing human violence and increasing tolerance and cooperation. As the next chapter explains, there are additional factors at play here, but capitalism did make an important contribution to global harmony by encouraging people to stop viewing the economy as a zero-sum game, in which your profit is my loss, and instead see it as a win-win situation, in which your profit is also my profit. This has probably helped global harmony far more than centuries of Christian preaching about loving your neighbor and turning the other cheek. From its belief in the supreme value of growth, capitalism deduces its number one commandment: thou shalt invest thy profits in increasing growth. For most of history, princes and priests wasted their profits in flamboyant carnivals, sumptuous palaces, and unnecessary wars. Alternatively, they put gold coins in an iron chest, sealed it, and buried it in a dungeon. Today, devout capitalists use their profits to hire new employees, enlarge the factory, or develop a new product. If they don't know how to do it themselves, they give their money to somebody who does, such as bankers and venture capitalists. The latter lend the money to various entrepreneurs. Farmers take loans to plant new wheat fields, contractors build new houses, energy corporations explore new oil fields, and arms factories develop new weapons. The profits from all these activities enable the entrepreneurs to repay their loans with interest. We now have not only more wheat, houses, oil, and weapons, but also more money which the banks and funds can again lend. This wheel will never stop, at least not according to capitalism. We will never reach a moment when capitalism says, "That's it, you've grown enough, you can now take it easy." If you want to know why the capitalist wheel is unlikely ever to stop, talk for an hour with a friend who has just earned $100,000 and wonders what to do with it. "The banks offer such low interest rates," he would complain. "I don't want to put my money in a savings account that pays hardly 0.5% a year. You can make perhaps 2% in government bonds. My cousin Richie bought a flat in Seattle last year and he has already made 20% on his investment. Maybe I should go into real estate too, but everybody is saying there's a new real estate bubble. So what do you think about the stock exchange?" A friend told me the best deal these days is to buy an ETF that follows emerging economies like Brazil or China. As he stops for a moment to breathe, you ask, "Well, why not just be satisfied with your $100,000? He will explain to you better than I can. He will explain to you better than I can why capitalism will never stop. This lesson is hammered home even to children and teenagers through ubiquitous capitalist games. Pre-modern games such as chess assumed a stagnant economy. You begin a game of chess with 16 pieces, and you never finish a game with more. In rare cases, a pawn may be transformed into a queen, but you cannot produce new pawns, nor can you upgrade your knights into tanks. So chess players never have to think about investment. In contrast, many modern board games and computer games revolve around investment and growth. Particularly telling are civilization-style strategy games such as Minecraft, The Settlers of Catan, or Sid Meier's Civilization. The game may be set in the Middle Ages, in the Stone Age, or in some imaginary fairyland, but the principles always remain the same, and they are always capitalist. Your aim is to establish a city, a kingdom, or maybe an entire civilization. You begin from a very modest base, perhaps just a village and its nearby fields. Your assets provide you with an initial income of wheat, wood, iron, or gold. You then have to invest this income wisely. You have to choose between unproductive but still necessary tools such as soldiers and productive assets such as more villages, fields, and mines. The winning strategy is usually to invest the barest minimum in non-productive essentials while maximizing your productive assets. Establishing additional villages means that next turn you will have a larger income that would enable you not only to buy more soldiers if necessary, but simultaneously to increase your investment in production. Soon, you could upgrade your villages to towns, build universities, harbors, and factories, explore the seas and oceans, establish your civilization, and win the game.